You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 438. We're back in style, full power, immediate posting. Here we are, backloads out, no more backlog, unclogged. We're rocking along, we're keeping along. Punk News Podcast 48, timely, here, in effect, on the hour, every hour, Punk News Podcast. Let's rock.
It's a long way to the promised land, so you better well know your way. There's a ship on the ocean and an albatross who is trying to lead you astray. Leaders, politicians, and power whores are in line to receive your choice. If you bet your ass, if you give it to them, they will gladly take your voice. And it's a long way.
Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast, and as you know by now, after years of backlog, years of having backlog issues, thanks to Adam White's quick thinking, we are now basically posting immediately or the day after. Adam White, hats off to you, sir, for solving this problem, but as a computer guy, that's what you do, isn't it? You solve technological problems and supply chain management issues. Is that not true?
I would say 95% of my life is probably more on the supply chain management side than the actual technical side. Because the actual technical side is, that's the interesting part, but that's rarely the problem. The problem is usually that you have to get a widget from point A to point B, and in between those two points, there's a bunch of unreliable dipshits, of which I am one, and those things don't always move the way they should because everybody's tired.
That's not the way I thought you were going to go, John, when you said that Adam was a problem solver. I thought it was going to be more like, if you've got a problem and no one else can help, call the A-Team, starring Adam White.
Adam White, if the local gang is threatening me and my elderly parents' donut shop, can you come drive up with a van and like shoot at them but not shoot them, and they'll panic and run
away?
He
shows up with his Mini 14 and drops 1,000 rounds of ammunition without wounding a soul. It's amazing.
See,
that's what he does.
You are both born and bred Americans, because both of your solutions to this problem was shoot into the air. You just chose different, like a different kind of ammunition for each of your scenarios. And you probably think that they're wildly different answers that you gave. But all I heard shoot into the air or shoot into the air with a different gun.
We were actually more mocking the show. They didn't shoot into the air. They shot at the bad guys. It's just no one ever got shot. It was a primetime show, and literally they would shoot thousands of rounds and no one ever got hurt.
Mm-hmm. And that's Tom Trauma, Punk News reviewer, regular Punk News reviewer, regular Punk News podcaster. Tom Trauma, A-Team, good show or great show?
I tell you, if you would have asked me 30-something years ago when it was on the air, I would have definitely said great show. But unfortunately, I've caught a few episodes of it since then, and I'm going to have to downgrade it to... just great. What was the choice? Is great or good or great? I'm gonna downgrade it to good. And even that, if you gave me another choice, I'd probably downgrade it further. But nevertheless, I loved it when I was a wee one.
Adam White, excellent use of taxonomy on such a quick turn of events.
You don't get paid extra for that, Adam.
Yeah,
that's one of my computer guy words. I use taxonomy 7 times a day.
It's like me and Urkel. When I was little, I loved Urkel, and then I saw it like 7 years ago, and it was so bad. But then I saw it again like a year ago, and it was so bad, it went back to being great again. Like, it's so unfunny that it's
like now it's good, ironically.
So anyways, we big news week this week. I don't know if we're going to touch on all of it. We got a lot of mail, too. Before we touch on the mail, I'm going to briefly do a recap of the Punk News Spring Showdown, which was a sequel to last year's Punk News Spring Slamdown. This year we had F Woods and the Fellow Humans. We had Natterers from the UK, which I'll talk about in a minute. We had the Drew Getz and Crazy in the Brains. It was in Philadelphia, Creep Records, March 24, I believe. It was a Friday, my first Friday show ever, I think. And it was just an awesome event. The whole thing was done like a Wild West shootout. I wore spurs and a cowboy hat, and I went on the stage.
Assless,
and I
said, assless chaps.
Fun fact, all chaps are assless. There's no such thing as ass chaps.
Well, did you wear anything underneath them, I guess, is the more appropriate.
I wore jeans like a true cowboy would. And so I went on the stage and I pulled out two cap guns and I'm like firing them in the air and I'm like, yee-haw, Philadelphia. Fun fact, when I bought the cap guns at a dollar store, first of all, the girl's like, well, the lady, she's like, are you throwing a kid's party? I was like, yeah. Then she said something like kind of creepy to me. I felt bad about it. She's like, guns aren't allowed. And I'm like, oh, it's for a costume party. And then she goes like really solemnly, like, guns aren't allowed. And I got the impression that guns had like really negatively affected her life. And I'm like, I'm a jackass. I'm like making guns a cartoon thing. And this lady is giving me like a desperate plea.
Wait, so anyway, were you buying them from her?
Well, from the dollar store.
But like, no, but did she, was she the person, was she the clerk at the dollar store or was she the person?
She was the clerk at the dollar store, yes.
Why didn't she, she should have like refused to sell you the guns.
I actually later on that day, I had someone try to refuse to sell me spray paint. And I was basically like, I didn't mean, so anyways, I'm at Home Depot and I'm buying spray paint. And I wanted to get it at the hardware store, but Home Depot was the only place around. So I'm buying spray paint and the lady says to me, what's your age? And I'm like, I'm not going to tell you my age. And I forgot that in Pennsylvania, at least you have to give your age to buy spray paint. And she's like, well, you have to give your age. And I still didn't realize why she was asking. I'm like, I'm not going to give my age.
What a great country we live in.
And I still didn't realize why she was asking that. And she asked it kind of rudely. So I'm like, I'm not giving you my age. She's like, well, then I'm not telling you spray paint. I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, you have to give your spray paint for it, to your age to buy spray paint. And so I'm like, fine, July 3, 1972. And she's like, that's not your birthday. I'm like, yes, it is. She's like,
you're older than me now, John. Congratulations.
I know. She's like, you're lying. I'm like, no, I'm not. Sell me the spray paint. And so anyways, I don't know if I was the dick there or not. If she had said to me, honestly, I've been so hardwired that whenever you go to a supermarket, at least in the States, they're like, oh, what's your phone number? You know, what's your address? Because they're trying to get you on the mailing list or whatever. And plus, you can get hacked that way. You know, so I'm so hardwired that I'm not going to give any information at all. And so I probably wouldn't have been such a dick if she wasn't rude to me first. So I'm not sure if I was a dick in that situation or not.
Insane, dude. Thank God the lawmakers of Pennsylvania are really focusing on what's important to protect you. I'm making it difficult to buy spray paint. Oh, you wonder why I hate the government so much.
So anyways, we threw the show. The show was awesome. F. Woods did kind of gothic punk kind of stuff, which was really cool. And boys, I got to say, next up was Natterers. And I got to say, Ricky was right all along. And honestly, I think a lot of people, whenever someone just constantly mentions a band, you kind of tune out, you're like, whatever. And Ricky was always talking about
Isn't Natterers. That us, John, with pretty much every Canadian band that Adam talks about?
Yeah, I'm about to get to that though. So honestly,
just busting your ass, Adam.
Natterers played their first USA show ever, and they were phenomenal. They're on tour right now. I think they've got about 2 or 3 weeks left on their tour. If you get a chance to go see Natterers, go see them. It is amazing hardcore. I would say it's about 1/3 hardcore, 1/3 anarcho punk, 1/3 punk rock, and they're just an amazing band. And honestly, I'm glad I threw the show with them on it. I kind of wish I'd make maybe somewhat of a bigger deal out of it, or maybe I sort of wish that I did an all hardcore. I'm against all single genre shows, but except for hardcore, if it's a non-hardcore audience, hardcore bands are often a little bit too rough for them, you know? And the audience was into it, but they weren't gone super crazy just because it was so explosive. Although some people did go crazy, but Natterers is the real deal. And that brings me to my next point is when someone keeps talking about a band nonstop, instead of phasing out or ignoring it, you should listen to it and check it out because Drew Goetz and Crazy in the Brains played. And I know I talk about them a lot. Drew Goetz were friggin' awesome. They banged through about a 25-minute set. And Crazy in the Brains, I don't know why Crazy in the Brains is the most famous band in the world. They are just getting better and better and better and better. And they were absolutely on fire at the Spring Showdown. You know, they did the xylophone thing. They wore fur coats. They're just an amazing band. So, I mean, nothing crazy happened except for Natterers really blew me away. All the bands blew me away. Natterers surprised me because I knew the least about them, but also Crazy in the Brains really surprised me just because they were so good. So
it was at a record store, John?
Yes.
So full house?
No, about 90 to 100 people.
Okay, but it only holds, 150 or something, 125?
150, yes.
Okay. But it was a good turnout. It was respectable.
Oh, it was total success. Everybody got paid and everyone had a good time. And that's what counts. Cool. And the band sold a lot of records too. A lot of people bought a lot of records, which was cool too.
Nice.
So I'll give everyone a bit of a scoop. We got a show coming up on May 4 and June 1. They're going to be announced on the website very soon. Maybe.
Holy cow, John.
I know.
You're becoming a maven.
I know
what it is. You got that thing going like all of us do where people reach out to you and you just can never say no to anything. You're just like, oh, sure, I don't have time, but I'll do it. Sure.
It's like, well, that's exactly like people have been reaching out. Well, one show I reached out to the people and both shows people reached out to me. But one of the ones, well, I'll just say it right here and then we'll announce one of the one show is going to be, well, one May 4 is going to be the Punk News Prom. I'm not going to give the details on that, but it's going to be a prom. And it's going to be awesome. Then June 1 is going to be absolutely insane. Scissor Crack backed by Crazy in the Brains. Danbert Nobacon of Chumbawamba doing his first Philly show in like 13 years. And it's going to be amazing. And Road Killer, which is a Australian thrash.
Oh, I know Road Killer, female fronted, right?
How do you know? They're relatively small. How do you know them?
I know lots of stuff, John.
True. So anyways.
I get, much like yourself, we get on these mailing lists. I get promos all day long. Once in a while, you're like, wow, that's an interesting name. It sounds interesting. 90% of them you delete with just after reading the first sentence of the description. But once in a while, something catches your eye. And that was one of those bands like, oh, that seems kind of cool. Check this out.
So I gotta cool my jets except for like awesome
stuff. Yeah, you're like once a month now, dude. Once a month, one show a month.
The more you do, the easier it is to do, which is nice. And plus, I kind of like punk news shows are relatively unique. Actually, they're really unique. No one else does shows. And actually,
that's the problem with doing too many. Scarcity of it is what kind of makes it unique. So when it becomes, you know, John G. Promotions presents.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to expect you to show up covered in glitter and throwing out, you know, condoms full of M&Ms.
Well, I do that pretty much every show, actually.
I know you do, but eventually you get tired.
That's true. Let's talk about this briefly, not to drag this out. So, and I don't know if I'm in the right about this or if I'm in the wrong. I'm not sure. So I'm very proud of the fact that punk news shows are really unique and the lineups are really unique. Like we did Joe Jack Talcum and Sister Crack last year. No one had done that before. And those two artists aren't alike really at all, but they sort of are. So the show makes sense. And I feel like we've done a lot of shows like that. There's another promoter in another major city outside of Philadelphia that's basically ripping off my bills after I approve that bill can work. And I'm very annoyed by this. But am I in the right to be annoyed by that? I mean, I don't own these bands, you know, legally I'm not, I can't copyright a lineup, you know, so I'm very annoyed by this, but maybe that's just fair game. You know,
say it again, Jen. What are you annoyed by?
So I don't want to get specific because I'm not looking at beefing with anybody, and I'm not sure I'm right to be annoyed by this. But another promoter in another major city is taking the unique bills that I'm putting together, band A, B, and C, and basically just copying them, doing band A, B, and C in a different city. And it'd be one thing if it was bands that always play together, but they're punk news shows of bands that don't usually play together, you know. But yeah. On the other hand, like, even if he copy, he can never beat me, you know. I mean, just because our shows are so weird and unique and we do weird and unique things, but I'm still annoyed. But on the other hand, maybe the onus is on me. Like, well, John, if it was successful in another city, maybe you should have thrown the bill in another city as well, you know.
Maybe you should just, like, embrace being a tastemaker.
Yep.
And let go of any bitterness you have. Either that, or maybe he booked one of the headliners and they say, hey, you know who would be great with that? This. We've already played this line. You know, it might have been the artist kind of coordinated putting it together too. So who knows?
I would say it is a combination of the two things. The fact that your shows are, you know, people are attending them and they're selling well, you're essentially proving that there is a market for that combination to exist. So, like, in a way, like, that other promoter is smart because they're not taking as much of a gamble on their end, right?
Well, see, I'm taking the gamble and he's getting the benefit. That's what annoys me, you know?
Well sure, but if you want to exclusively...
Trendsetters always have to take the risk, John.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to exclusively do shows that are not going to cause ripples in the outside world, then do mystery bills that you don't promote.
Yeah, there you go. At donut shops.
Well, anyways, Natters is the real deal. Check them out. Let's hit some mail. You can always use that podcast at punknews.org. This is from Liverpool Neil. Hello, chaps. Liverpool Neil here with a couple of thoughts from the last two episodes. Adam, your attitude on the whole Mongol Horde band name debate was so wimpy it was shocking. Wow. Look, it's punk rock. We are supposed to have offensive band names. Damn how times have changed. 30 years ago it was Nancy Reagan who wanted to censor punk rock. Now we are doing it from the inside. This is insanity. If it was up to the new punk moral majority, there would be no Sex Pistols, no Dead Kennedys, no Dago Abortions, no Angry Samoans, or a million other offensive band names. It's simple. If Koji doesn't like the name, then he doesn't have to buy anything by them or listen to them. He has the right to be offended, but he doesn't have the right to force his beliefs and feelings on everybody else. Adam, you want to respond to that, or you just want to let that one fly?
We've recorded 700 podcasts since then, so I don't remember what my particular wimpy opinion on that was. But so I'll just take my lumps.
Number two, why oh why in punk rock documentaries do we always get the same old punk experts? Rollins, Grohl, McKay, and Flea. And why are they always American? Good point, Liverpool Neil. It's weird how they always interview the same faces, most of whom haven't made a punk rock record in 25 years. You want somebody with some history, well, that's fine, but how about interviewing a Brit for a change? TV Smith, perhaps? Or how about Charlie Harper or Steve Ignorant?
John Lydon, that always works out well.
Actually, let's talk. We actually have a letter about that in a minute. People that are still doing it and living it 24/7. And finally, a new drinking game. Whenever John claims a band is one of his favorite bands of all time, we all take a shot. I swear we will be hammered by the end of each show. John's list of favorite bands must encompass basically every band. Thanks to the podcast, guys. Loving the new classic crew. Stay free from Liverpool, Neil.
Love that. Love it. I wish I had some booze. I would do that, but unfortunately I don't have any. But I would definitely have to take a shot for Natters and Crazy in the Brains. I'd be at least two shots in, John.
This is from Nicholas C. We got another Nick writing in. Hi all, I just wanted to add my two cents on the Mongol Horde racism controversy. There are two perspectives on the subject, and in both, Koji comes out on the loser end of the discussion. First, let's talk about the band name. Taking into account all the points John made about the name of the band, and even if it is just a name to be used for shock value, how is this name different than any other of all the band names in the 70s? Buzzcocks, Sex Pistols, etc. All those names are chosen for shock value, to make a statement, or to create controversy. Mongol Horde doesn't really sound like anything. It's just a name. It's not a racial slur. It's not directly offensive to anyone. Even if it is offensive, who said that punk rock can't be offensive? And when did we enter a punk is a clean thing for everyone? Punk is meant to be offensive as an avenue to make you think and find out for yourself. I didn't know anything about Mongolia, and now thanks to Mongol Horde, I know lots about the country, the culture, and the history. to me,
beyond Mongolian beef, the Mongolian history.
To me, they completely fulfill their goal, make us all feel better. Koji Zero, Mongol Horde One. And then he continues. Then there's the question of why attacking Mongol Horde for being racist. Okay, then there's a question of why is attacking Mongol Horde for being racist? Then why not go after the Chinkies? While that name doesn't mean anything, it sounded a lot more like a racial slur towards Chinese people than Mongol Horde. Why isn't Koji going after them? Is it because Mike Park is Asian looking? He's not even of Chinese descent, so who is racist now?
He's of some Asian descent.
Well, Mike Park is. His parents are Korean. He's Korean American. Yeah. I don't know if Chinky is strictly for Chinese people. I don't believe it is as a racial slur, but maybe it is. I think
that's kind of a generic like Asian slur.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, Mike Park. Like, I don't know him personally. I shouldn't say it like that. But Mike Park has always been a guy who's sort of made fun of like racism against Asians. You know what I mean? He's always used some terms that would definitely be considered offensive if they're being used by an outside party. It's kind of like the way rappers talk, honestly.
Nick C continues. Go ahead, Adam.
I just want to split a very pedantic hair here. If you want to have the opinion that I don't care that I'm being offensive or I'm intending to be offensive, so fuck you, I'm going to do what I want, that's great. I mean, that's fine. That's your prerogative, and I'm not going to fight against that at all. But you can't, as a justification for that, say something like, well, Mongol isn't actually offensive to whoever. Because you can't say what's offensive to other people. Because you're not the other people. That's the whole point of
being able to. My fear, Adam, is we live in a culture where people who don't really have a right to be offended are the ones who are always offended. No, it always seems like the overeducated white people are always the ones who are offended about it.
You are fully, I think, within your speech rights or whatever to go, I'm going to be offensive and you're going to have to, you're going to have to deal with the fact that I'm going to be offensive because it's not, truly hurting anyone. And that person can be mad at you and you can be offensive and maybe you're being a dick or maybe you're not, but fine, you can do that. Just don't do it and then justify it by saying, well, but this isn't really offensive to so-and-so. Well, but like you're not so-and-so. You don't know that. So that part of the argument I'll push back against, because that's a little bit too much of, you know, sitting back and going, well, look, from my white guy chair, here's how I understand the world works, and therefore da 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 da. Like, no, like you have to accept that, like, you know, people can be offended by whatever they want. You don't have to, you know, capitulate to their demands, but you can't tell them that they can't be offended.
But can you say someone's being offended unreasonably? And we've had this discussion before, so we don't need to rehash it out. But if someone made a band called the Meatballs, I could say, oh, I'm offended as an Italian-American, but not really, you know?
Or if they all wear, like, gold ram's horn necklaces.
You can have the opinion that, you're going to discount what they're offended about because you don't believe it's truly offended. But you offensive, but you don't have their perspective. Like, you can't say this is not offensive to this or that people if you are not this or that people. It doesn't matter how ridiculous.
I don't know if I can agree with that statement or not. Maybe I can. I'm not going to fight that to the death, but I'm not. I have to think about that if I can agree with that statement or not.
John,
don't you think we live in a culture of people who are offended for other people?
Although, hey,
I see that
Let's keep splitting the hair because I agree with you there. If the situation,
but I don't know what Koji is some sort of Asian background, but I don't know what his background is.
Not going to gatekeep if he's the right kind of Asian or anything like that. All I'm saying is that take some part of the world that you know absolutely nothing about, right? So let's say I know nothing about, say, the people of Argentina, like zero. I know they have good steak there, right? So
they're lovely people, Adam. You should really learn about Argentina.
Let's say an Argentinian guy came up to me and said, I am offended because you have purchased a pineapple today, and that is offensive to my people, right? And I'm standing there in the store with a pineapple. No, I don't know anything about the people of Argentina. I don't know if that pineapple is actually offensive. Now, I'm still going to buy that pineapple. I'm still within my right to do that. I can choose not to, or I could choose to, and they're going to have to deal with that, and I'll deal with the consequences of that. But I am not going to say to him, this is not offensive to you. That's all I'm saying. I'm just like, you can't make that presumption.
But it doesn't change your behavior.
It doesn't necessarily change your behavior. You can choose how it's going to change your behavior, but you can't dictate if it's offensive or not.
But I kind of, you're right. And you're right. You can't dictate. Anybody who's been married for a few years knows that you can't dictate what people find offensive. Your spouse, for example.
Oh yeah. That's a good thing.
But the fact of the matter is in society, Adam, though, I agree with John that there has to be a reasonableness standard applied to things. Does it offend? I mean, somebody's offended about everything, but we can't cater to that element of society.
No, I'm not saying that anyone needs to cater to that element of society at all. I'm just saying that you have to be, like, you know, conscious enough that, you know, the world doesn't revolve around you to at least admit that perhaps this actually is offensive to someone, and then, you know, and then do what you will with that information, but don't declare that something.
I mean, yeah, you don't want to go too far, and you don't want to be the guy who's just sort of say it like it is guy who's kind of like a dick just for the sake of being a dick. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But like I said, I think there can be a reasonableness standard applied. And I also happen to think that I'm the best arbiter of what that reasonable standard is. So.
Okay, continue the letter. Continue the letter there.
Nick C continues. Why isn't Koji going after the Chinkies? Is it because Mike Park is Asian looking and he's not even of Chinese descent? So who is racist now? It seems to me that Koji is picking and choosing what racism is, which Mongol Horde isn't. Maybe Koji doesn't go after Mike Park because he doesn't know about the Chinkies or because they aren't a band anymore. In either case, inform yourself, Koji, because it looks like you are chasing a couple of cheap retweets. Koji decided to go after the biggest superstar in punk and folk singer and songwriter to make a name to make a name for himself. Mind that there are other people in the band. Why go after Frank Turner, not the rest of the band? If Koji's music doesn't cut it to make him relevant enough to be a topic of conversation, he shouldn't become the racism police to make himself more noticed. Maybe put more work into your music, less attention to being noticed and getting a following for the wrong reasons. Koji Zero, Uncle Horde too. And then Nicholas wraps up his statement here. We shouldn't try to clean out punk and make it not offensive. Punk should be a driver of discussion and growth so that everyone is included. If we don't want to offend anyone, let's make Warren Women change their name. Let's make MDC change their name. Let's make the Queers change their name. And that can be said for a lot of other bands. I think there's a place for discussion about what is acceptable and what is not, but such a selective, accusative tone or style definitely has no leg to stand on. This is not Salem, Koji. If you want to generate a discussion, open a discussion, questioning everything and everyone, do it at the correct place and forum. Don't become the judge and executioner of what you think is proper. If Koji just wants to create a buzz for himself, sure, go to Twitter and throw argument, less accusations to famous people. That just shows there is no place for him in our scene, and that's from Nick C.
Nick C is fired up, man.
Nick C is fired up. We've got actually a bunch of more mail. Do you guys want to touch on that now, or do you guys want to kick off the show proper?
What do you want to do, dude?
Adam, do
one more. We'll cut this. Well, you already cut that story we didn't want to talk about because it's boring. Okay, yeah, do the mail.
Okay. So anyway, if we didn't get your mail this week, we will get to it next week. This is a mail from Tim, and Tim just says the following. Did you see the John Biden episode of his panel about the punk rock Iggy Pop show? How did you think he came off? I think he came off as a drunk twat, from Tim.
Oh, I hope that guy's British because you're not allowed to say that word in America.
You know what? I didn't actually watch the damn thing. I only saw reaction to it. I saw like screenshots of angry Johnny and angry Johnny
Marky,
angry Marky and angry John Lydon. Did you want to give some context here about what this was for the listeners who haven't seen this yet?
Yeah, sure. I actually watched the whole thing, and I reckon it's about a 30-minute long clip. Iggy Pop's got a TV. He's not in the panel for some reason. Well, actually, John Varvatos has a show coming out, and he is in the panel. John Varvatos has a 4 or 6 episode show coming out where Iggy Pop basically interviews other punk rock musicians. He interviews all the classics, you know, John Lydon, some of the Ramones, some of the New York Dolls,
some of the people that Neil complained about earlier that are on everything, probably
Henry Rollins, L7. Yep. And so they recently had a panel where basically it was a panel basically to promote the upcoming show. And the audience basically just asked the panel members questions. It was John Lydon, Marky Ramone, Henry Rollins, Donita Sparks. I think the guy from Guns N' Roses. Who was the punk?
Duff McKagan.
It was Duff. Okay, then it was Duff.
He's the punk guy from Seattle. He was in. He was briefly in the
Farts.
Oh, the Farts. You got it, Jeff.
So you're right, it was Duff. Anyway, so it was a panel, and basically, as soon as the first question is asked, Lydon just goes off the hook, and for the next 30 minutes, it's literally basically Lydon ranting and people trying to break through, and he and Marky get in a real spar. And well, my perspective is that Lydon beat the crap out of Marky argument wise, but not everyone had that opinion.
Well, the thing that I saw that really sparked the thing was. And this is obviously incorrect. Marky's crazy on this. He doesn't know anything about the history of that band. If he said didn't he say something along the lines of Sid was the real star of that band?
He said that. I don't think he really feels that way. I think he said
no. I mean, you can't feel that way. Johnny was so the star of that band, but whatever. But anyway, I didn't watch the whole thing, but Johnny doesn't look good. He doesn't look good.
I'm split on this, and here's why. Lydon is famously whip smart, extremely intelligent, and famously great at like destroying interviews.
Reactionary. Yep.
He didn't do this like in this thing. He just kind of blathered and like really wasn't as sharp. He has been like he's been like just a destroyer in the past. But in the past couple of years, maybe he's fallen off a little bit. However, there's a lot of things going on in his life that I don't know if all of them are public, and I would actually give him a pretty good pass. That being said,
I love that you know things that are going on in Johnny Rotten's life that aren't public, John.
Well,
because I don't.
Well, we can talk about it afterwards. If you think about it a little bit, you can figure it out.
I forgot what an A-list you were with your constant gig booking, and I forgot how far inside the circle you are, the tiny circle of punk rockdom.
Yeah, throwing $5 to $10 shows. Exactly. I'm really the next Golden Voice. Let me tell you.
You're gonna be booking PIL next.
Yeah, I would book PIL for sure. Anyways, I was hoping that Lydon would be a little bit sharper. He wasn't that sharp. But that being said, Lydon comes off. I mean, Lydon considers himself the creator of punk rock. You could go back and forth on that. Who knows? You know. That being said, is lot like all the other punk, all the other punks, they just sit there and they answer questions like it's a library forum. Lydon just causes so much chaos and destruction, and he just completely destroys the whole purpose of the thing. And isn't that what John Lydon does? Isn't that what the Sex Pistols do? Just like subvert and destroy and cause chaos, and whatever plans you have, just thwart them entirely. And that's exactly what he did. So I think I have to side with Lydon on that one. I wish he was a bit sharper, but that being said, I love the fact that he really is an uncontrollable chaos. And to me, that's what Lydon is.
From the pictures that I saw of this, then this is partly the reason why I didn't go sit down and watch it is there's something about my perception of these people that bristles at having them all sitting there in chairs having a panel discussion together. Like
panel discussions aren't punk rock.
Yeah, but just it pulls back the veil in a way that I don't want it to. It's like the end of a play when all of a sudden all the cast comes out on stage to bow, and like the hero and the villain are standing there holding hands and bowing, and you're like, oh, they're all actors and this is just a play that I'm watching, right? Like there's something about it where I'm like none of you people should be sitting here together on stage, you know, crossing, you know, with all of your, you all have fascinating stories of your own. I don't want them all intersecting at this juncture when you're all fat and slow and old, and it's just like it's not what I
maybe,
want. Like,
maybe Johnny sensed that too, Adam, and that's maybe why he tried to throw a wrench in the gears.
It's lame. I mean, by all means, have a documentary that involves all of these people, but interview each of them in a different dirty bathroom somewhere.
It's funny that's what bothers you. I don't know why. I think that's
Something about the forum of it, and I realize I'm right now arguing that like I want my rock and roll to be more manufactured for my personal narrative.
No,
right?
It's not even that. I'm sorry. Finish up, and I'll.
But
tell
it's just
you.
It is rock and roll. So like there is a certain like image matters. Like the mystique of the band matters. Like I don't want them all sitting there blabbing to each other on a stage. In a way, I never want outside of some story from back in the day about when this band or that band sort of ran into each other on the road or at a show or something, like I don't want my Sex Pistols and my Ramones on speaking terms. Like I don't want them intersecting with each other like that at this point. Like I want those things elsewise, and we don't gain anything by having them all, you know, together spitting at each other.
I just like seeing Lydon like just make up the just rip Marky in half.
Oh, I mean, like that's the best of a bad situation.
We talked about last year. I went to that camp out thing in Ohio, and it was Keith Morris and Jello Biafra and guys Fletcher from Pennywise and just a wide cast of characters. Jack Grisham from TSOL.
But you told me that was a small thing, right? Like it was,
but it was fascinating, Adam.
It was intimate.
Well, most of the crowd left. It was intimate in that most of the crowd left and we were just gathered up by the front of the stage, maybe a few hundred people instead of a few thousand people, but it was fascinating. But I kind of get what you're saying in that. Let me put a slightly different spin on that. I am slow to want to over intellectualize something that needs to be felt deep in your bowels. And that's the way the music needs to be experienced. And all these kids who are writing their doctoral thesis on the power of punk rock, it's just not, you can't exactly put it in words. You know, it's like, let's stop over intellectualizing this stuff and just listen to the damn records and take it for what it's supposed to be, something you feel. So that being said, nobody reads more autobiographies of punk rock people than I do. Nobody watches more documentaries than I do. So, maybe I'm just being a hypocrite, hypocritical twat, or whatever that other guy said.
But like, you know what? I'm okay with each of those people on stage telling me their own.
I just think it's weird because I totally don't get that what your deal is with that. But I respect your right to be bitter about it.
Yeah, like I want, like by all means, have each
you've
of
reached
those,
that age where you can do that, Adam.
Like each of those people can lie to me and give me their own bullshit about what happened. And I'm okay with that because I'm more in it because I enjoy those stories. Like I enjoy the story.
Like the anecdote.
I enjoy the anecdote and the story of the remote. This is why like something like Please Kill Me is such like a fascinating thing to go read through, right? When it's full of all these like little chunks and anecdotes and stuff like that, right? So yeah. I
David Bowie banging 14-year-olds, the Stooges banging 14-year-olds.
Wow, like man, subject matter notwithstanding,
collapsed veins from shooting so much junk into their arms.
Right, but I kind of want the anecdotes. Like I'm okay if it's all a lie because like whatever. I'm not going to go back in time and be like. You know, did this relationship breakdown between Johnny and Joey actually break down along the lines that they said? Or like, where's the middle ground in this? Like, I don't really care what the truth is. I don't want all these people to sit down and like argue out what actually happened, because who fucking cares what actually happened, right?
The Ramones are the best on that, because if you read every one of their biographies, they all tell a different story. You know, like the classic, who's the Uber producer who
Phil Spector,
the Phil Spector pulled a gun on us. Like they all tell the story, but it's all slightly different. They all agree that he was a crackhead and pulled out a gun on him, but all the rest of it is sort of, yeah, they were the best. They were such finger pointers. They all blamed each other for everything. I don't know if the pistols are like that or not. I think Johnny and Glenn Matlock and Steve Jones have actually aged fairly gracefully.
I have one of their books that was sent to me that I never opened, that is sitting on a shelf somewhere. One of them, I think Steve Jones just wrote a book called Lonely Boy. That is,
I want to read that.
I have a copy of it sitting here.
But like, right. I read the most recent Ramones book I read was Marky's autobiography, I think. And he just painted a horrible picture of Johnny, especially. Marky was especially vicious of a guy who's been dead for several years now. But anyway, I'm sorry. We're off track.
I guess what I'm getting at is that like, I don't, oh, I mean, but I had a good analogy about this in my head, and then just, oh no, I know what it is, right? Let's say you're at a restaurant, and this is a good analogy. This is a great analogy. Okay. Let's say you're at a restaurant. It's like it's a high end steakhouse. Okay. And if it's a high end steakhouse,
there's nothing punk about a high end
steakhouse. Let's just say you're at a high end steakhouse, right? You're having, I'm sorry, vegans, you're having, you know, you got a really, really nice cut in front of you. You got all.
Can I be a Fogo de Chao? Can I be a Fogo de Chao?
Sure. You got all the trimmings. It's all great. You got a nice beverage. You're there with your special lady friend, Tom. Your kids are not there. You're in a nice steakhouse.
Does my wife know that I'm with my special lady friend?
That's up to you. All the lighting in the steakhouse, it's dimmed. They got some lights over the tables. They don't have lights everywhere, right? They're trying to give it this dark feeling to it, right? There's some candles on the table. It's done up nice. It's staged well, right? You could go in that exact room and put fucking fluorescent lights everywhere and turn them all up to full blast, and then serve the exact same food and have the exact same people that you're there with and everything. But it's bright and shitty at that point, right? You see more. There's more detail in the room at that point, but you're like, ugh, like there was some ambience here, and now there is not. Now it feels like I'm in the fucking mall, right?
Gosh, now I'm just like. I got several analogies now. I mean, you just keep going. You finish up.
We should just do analogies this whole show and not talk about
it. It's like, you know, like, hey, most people like M&Ms. Most people like Skittles. When you mix them together, it sort of sucks, right? Or like to be a little more, you know, like there's that Playboy style of photography. And then there's the hardcore, like hustler style, which is almost like gynecological, where you're like, that's not sexy. I see the insides. You know what I mean? So,
well, I've got an analogy.
You don't want to be a gynecologist. You just want the like Playboy style. Huh?
I've got an analogy for you too. Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. Shaka, when the walls fell. Let's play a song.
All right. So, okay, here you go. I have been listening to a lot of Uranium Club recently. This is a band from Minneapolis, I believe, Minnesota at the very least. They have influences.
Still Canada adjacent, right?
Still Canada adjacent. They are very. I'm going to adopt them. They should be one of ours. They have influence kind of from like all the good stuff. They sound like Devo. They sound like really early Wire. They sound like The Fall a little bit. Everything they do is great, and a lot of the music that they put together is full of. You want to come back to John Lydon here? Is full of like just attitude and weirdness and like little vocal ticks that kick in at various points in the songs that express just so much more of what I think of as punk rock than your generic like melodic hardcore band ever reaches. So they have a record that just came out called The Cosmo Cleaners, I believe that's what it's called. Let's find out. The Cosmo Cleaners, Googling stuff on the podcast. Yeah, okay. It came out on Static Shock Records in the UK, I believe they're carrying it. So this record came out in early March. It is 7 songs, 40 minutes. Some of these songs are long because the band goes all over the fucking place, but you never feel like you're listening to a band that is, you know, recording long stuff. All their stuff just cranks along and stops and starts and has all sorts of just bizarre moments. So here we go. So with that disclaimer, I'm going to play you a 5-minute song from this record. So the song is called Man is the Loneliest Animal. And it's almost like 2 songs. This thing starts off, it eases its way in. It sounds a little bit indie rock. It goes for a couple minutes. And then all of a sudden, just the brakes fail and things just go bananas for the remainder of it. So this is Man is the Loneliest Animal from Uranium Club, sometimes called the Minneapolis Uranium Club. They've used both names on stuff. From the record, The Cosmo Cleaners on Static Shock.
Born on Sunday, beautiful baby with the cadence and all the things of our precious lives. Sunday morning when she came singing and dancing with all of her smiles. I can't remember the way that you cried or the way that she died. I just sat safely in my own denial. A newborn baby of red and white, running naked, screaming through the lobby. If you could have been there, you would have seen it, and you would have been speechless in your own surprise. This healthy child doesn't need the cold actions shoved into her mind. And then you cut your fingers on the corners of the light, and it's Sunday, bloody Sunday, it's Sunday, bloody Sunday, 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 Sunday. We'll be right back.
And that was the Cosmo Cleaners. And let's jump into our episode here. We're already basically at closing time.
Yeah.
And we're kicking along. Listen, Avail, they're getting back together, and a lot of people are excited. They have not played together for about 12 years, and they're going to play one show down in Richmond, Virginia on July 19. It's the first show in 12 years, and they're going to celebrate 21 years of the album Over the James with the Over the James lineup. Openers are Iron Reagan and Asylum. They have no plans to release an album as of right now or anything beyond this first show, but people are excited. Adam and Tom, Tom and Adam, are you too excited for Avail? They're back, and they're ready to rock.
I was never a huge Avail fan. I would file them under bands that I always kind of meant to double back and check out a little bit, but I'm only vaguely familiar with them, and I am not really into them. I don't have anything against them. I'm not really into them. Probably a little too old for their prime.
I approach this in much the same way as you did while they were around. There's a handful of bands that were within that Epitaph realm that were not skate punk bands per se.
They had a couple albums on Fat.
Yeah.
Most of them were on the smaller label. I can't remember.
They were on Lookout earlier. Like Over the James is a Lookout record when it first came out.
Was it?
Yeah.
On Lookout?
No, it was on Lookout.
Man, I was so big into Lookout, but that was probably towards after I was kind of done with it.
But so there's a handful of bands that I've always sort of held in that regard where, like, if I hear a song from them, I'm down with this. This is cool. This is some decent punk rock. But there was never anything like personality wise about the band enough that grabbed me. So there's bands like, and some of these might make you mad, Tom, and I'm sorry. So like Swingin' Utters are in that category for me. Avail is in that category for me. Like Good Riddance is one of those bands. Like even I'm even to go and say like Dag Nasty is almost like that to me somewhat. We're like, well, I'll go and I'll listen to one of these songs.
Those are pretty disparate bunch of bands, but you can lump them all together if you want.
I'm going to lump them all together. Not that they sound the same, but they're just like, they're bands I'll run into them and I go, hey, this is cool. But then I will never, they'll never pop up in my head as something that I need to circle back to because there's just something about it that doesn't hook me. That said, I sat down today and listen to Over the James at some point in my afternoon. And I haven't heard that record in a long, long, long time. I was fucking into it. And I was into Avail in a way that I had not been into Avail ever in my life. So I am, as of right now, today, in whatever the fuck year it is, I'm at peak Avail fandom. So
it's Over the James. If I want to check out an album tomorrow, I'm probably gonna have time to listen to some music tomorrow. Is Over the James the one I want to listen to?
I don't know compared to their other ones, but it was totally fine to me. I was listening to the, it came out in
1990. That's a ringing endorsement. Totally fine.
No, it was good. It came out in 1998 originally. Yes. There was a reissue of it on Epitaph in like 2006, which is probably where the digital audio that I was listening to came from. But like it is like as far as that melodic hardcore sound goes, this is probably the peak of it. Like
a lot of people around the org love them.
It's not goofy in any way, right? So as much as you might want to say that like that NoFX plays in that ballpark, like that it totally absolutely a different animal because NoFX trades so much on personality and comedy and, you know, all their kind of weird quirks and stuff like that. And Avail, to their detriment, I guess, are not a weird band in any which way, shape, or form. Like they are a band that, you know, is going to play music with, you know, guitar and drums and vocals that is supposed to be, you know, loud and get your blood pumping. I think, you know, in a lot of the same way that say, like, you know, Avail was always a strung out style band for me. That's another band I'm throwing into that pile, right? Of bands that just exist that I have nothing against that I was never really into.
But wasn't strung out a little more metally?
They were more metally and more mathy to a degree. They were that for punks, right? Where if you were, I think, an actual metal person or a math rock person or whatever, like you would scoff at it. But for the punks, yeah, they were totally more down that road. But I'm not going to say a bad word about Over the James. It's a totally fine record. And if that's what they're getting back together to celebrate, then, you know, I'm down. I feel bad that I was not more into Avail back in the day is what I'm getting at. So I'm as much as my uninformed opinion on this matters.
It's not too late, dude. Jump in your car and drive to Richmond.
I'm not doing that, but, that, you know what? I've thought about that sometimes with some of these shows, and I see people get really excited about that are like reunion shows. And to a degree, I'm like, maybe you should just leave it alone, dude. Like there are certain people, like they talk about like Bikini Kill when they got back together and they booked those shows. Now those shows sold out because of like ticket robots. I mean, they were going to sell it anyways, but they sold out instantly because of the ticket robots. But there are people that I know online that got really excited about it and were talking about it and something like that. But I'm looking at them and I'm going like, I'm pretty sure you're like 26. So like when this,
yeah, they don't have the responsibilities that maybe we do.
No, it's not that. I mean, like, hey, if you're 26, by all means, drive to Richmond to go see a band. No, what I was getting at was that like that band was not your band. Like you were a child when that band was in their heyday.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, if that band is going to tour, then yeah, go see them. Go see what it's all about. That's cool. But if they're getting together to play like a one-off show, like, I don't know, like leave that ticket for the person that, you know, that has a history, right? That, and you know, I like
some, just guy, some just shows up cause his girlfriend's into it.
Yeah. Like I'd be bummed out if you went to one of those shows and someone couldn't, and the person that couldn't, you know, that they, you know, they suffered for that band back in the day when they were first around. Like, I'd feel like a total dick if I just like on a whim, you know, took some of my middle class income money and bought a plane ticket and went to New York and then saw Bikini Kill. But, you know, I'm going to go like, all right, you know, I listened to them on the internet a bunch. Meanwhile, someone that, you know, has the fucking tattoo couldn't get a ticket. I would feel bad about that. So, yeah, yeah. I'm not driving to Richmond to go see Avail for that reason.
Good for you, Adam.
I'm a saint, really.
I'm not driving 3 hours to see the Misfits either, but it's more of an attitude because they're playing in an arena. Well, that was weird.
That is weird.
I did drive 2.5 hours to see the Misfits in an arena, and I drove like 10 hours to see Flag, and it was worth it.
Well, you know, yeah, it's, and I'm not saying I wouldn't do that under certain, you know, if I could see the Misfits play in a club.
Yeah.
But it's just not, it's just not the way it works. I mean, I understand how the world works, and it's just not to be. And I'm not of the age where I'm a freaking bunch of Misfits fans to get to the front in a freaking basketball arena.
Misfits are a different strata. I'm thinking more that like, you know, well-regarded scene band that hasn't crossed over into like the wider.
What would that band be for me? I don't know. I have very few bands left on my bucket list, and most of them are small and West Coast, you know?
Well, speaking of small punk bands, Bad Religion have released a new track. It's called Do the Paranoid Style, which, of course, is reference to a famous track. And that's off their upcoming album, The Age of Unreason, out May 3 via Epitaph, of course.
What's that a reference to, John?
It's a reference to some book that came out in the 30s. World Inferno actually referenced it about 3 years ago. They had a fictional band called the Paranoid Style.
I knew it was a reference to something, but I just don't know what it was. I should have Googled it.
So are you guys excited? Do you dig? It's an essay by American historian Richard J. Hofstadter from 1964. And basically it's about, political movements and how they affect are affected and are not affected by the political system.
Sounds fascinating. I thought the song was all right. I didn't think it was amazing. I thought it was all right. What about you, Adam? You're a fan, right?
Yeah, I am. This is a fastier, buzzier Latter-day Bad Religion song. And it's a move that they've pulled, I feel like, more in their later years than earlier. So like this is like a little bit more in the realm of, say, like Supersonic or yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Like I was gonna say, yeah, like Supersonic anything off the Process of Belief
post 2000
or like maybe even a little bit of like of Sinister Rouge off the Empire Strikes First. But
yeah, I kind of lump all those post 2000 albums together. I know it's not fair. I mean, we're talking like 19 years now. But
yeah. Well, no, but there's a
once
definite.
Once they came back from Atlantic, I kind of lump all those albums back together.
But there was there's a sound to that whole this whole era that we're still in, yeah. Right? That they haven't quite got away from. This one, I'm not sure. I've listened to it three or four times. I'm like, I'm chewing on it. I'm turning it over in my mouth. I'm like,
it would have been a middle of the road song on True North, which was a pretty damn good album.
There is something honestly about all of these Bad Religion songs that have come out, let's say within the past year, that just aren't firing for me.
I think they're producing them to death.
I'm worried. I don't know what it is. Like, I'm worried that it's me.
Nah, you're right, Adam. It's we're getting older and you know, your tastes change, but I think they need a little more rawness. I think they need to, like I said, a little less production, just pull up a little bit on the production.
I mean, there was a reason for it at first. So like when Brett got back together with them, all of a sudden they were a band that had three guitar players in it. And yep. when Process came out, it sounded like a record that had, where they had three guitar players.
It was like, that album was really a shot. It had a shot of adrenaline to it compared to, I mean, the last two albums they made for Atlantic were bad, man. Mm-hmm. Even the best of the two for Atlantic, I didn't think were all that great, but the last two were really bad, but they were on a four record run before they went to Atlantic. I think it was Atlantic, right?
Yeah, they
had a four record run for Epitaph that was as good as just about anybody. It was Suffer, Against the Grain, No Control.
Sorry,
No Control and Generator.
Oh yeah,
that run was so good.
And then
they were losing steam, and most of us had kind of given up hope, honestly. And then Process of Belief comes out, we're like, holy cow, yeah, that's really good.
The Atlantic stuff was happening sort of like concurrently with when I was really getting into punk rock. So it was, I have a difficult history with a lot of those, but like one of the most
Beaver Hate was the best. And then they kind of went downhill from there. Honestly, yeah, it's like, each one was like, progressively worse.
One of the, was Recipe before or after Stranger Than Fiction? It was before.
After.
Was it after?
No, you're right. You know what? You're right. No, it was Recipe, then Stranger Than Fiction, then The Gray Race.
I feel like Recipe was the in between. Like Recipe may have even been picked up by.
Was
the
that
major.
Still on Epitaph? That, you know, that might have been what it was. It might have come on Epitaph and Atlantic re-release.
So while I don't even know if I was aware of like the big singles that they had off of Stranger Than Fiction when it came out, but the huge thing for me was All Ages, which was the comp. That they
put live
out.
Album?
Yeah, no, it wasn't. All Ages wasn't the live one. It was a best of compilation that Epitaph put out in like in 95, 96.
Yeah, I don't even get that because I had all the albums.
Yeah, and like, but it was there to like capitalize, I think, on the like the Green Day, Rancid, Offspring punk boom of the time, right? But it was like it fucking wrecked my life. Like it was my first time hearing like basically all the good songs off of like Generator, No Control, and all the other early ones, right? So that record was just, that comp was just like totally huge for me. And then, yeah, all the Atlantic stuff, you know, I go back and forth in a lot of it. You know, like there were some cool songs on Stranger Than Fiction.
Yeah, Stranger Than Fiction had a handful of good songs.
But like the Gray Race falls flat for me. I mean, no one even admits that No Substance exists anymore.
I think the New America might actually be worse than No Substance. The New America didn't really have anything redeeming. Cool,
I will defend most of the New America.
Ugh.
No, I won't defend it as necessarily a like a punk record, but just as like an alt rock record. I think that the New America, except for like, you know, like I Love My Computer. Let's not go crazy here, right? But
there was the Hopeless House. Oh my gosh.
Okay. All right.
It's bad, dude.
Stop listing the songs that are actually bad. So right. But there are songs.
I mean, I love the band, so I feel like I can criticize them.
Yeah. Okay. But that was a time and place record for me. That was, what was it, 2000, 2001?
Should have been somewhere else, Adam.
Oh, it mattered. It mattered in my life. But anyways, yeah, Process was such a...
Memories. Street Kid Named Desire. Ooh!
All right, I'm going to look at the track listing of this and see what I can defend.
Don't tell me Short, the last song was okay.
Yeah, Bad Religion, they're great, man. I love their albums. Man, they're so good with their melodic take on punk rock and
highly processed vocals. John, shut up. Okay, hold on here.
Melodic take on punk, John.
All right, you've got a chance. Don't hold fine.
New funk story.
Long Way to the Promised Land is a good alt-rock song. It's not a good punk song, but it's fine. It's fine. New America, I can deal with.
Wake up the new America.
It's like a Foreigner song.
Believe It, the record
with Michael Stipe background vocals. That's what it sounded like.
Believe It was the song they had Mr. Brett come back and do, so that was cool. All right, fine. It's a good EP and a bunch of shit. Anyways, they're
a good EP, maybe a decent EP.
All right, fine. It's a decent EP and a bunch of
it's
shit.
It's great.
That has emotional resonance.
But that four record run was so good that I can almost forgive all sins, because how many bands have four great records in a row? Not very many.
The Melvins.
I thought John was going to start listing Danzig records. Danzig 1, Danzig 2, Danzig 12.
Danzig the fourth 1, 2, 3, Danzig album is not great. Yes, yes. It's good. Not great. First three are pretty much bulletproof.
Tom, you are so off base with that comment. Anyways.
Danzig, so don't even start with me.
So, okay.
Are you guys done patting Bad Religion on the back, or you guys want
to
keep?
No, so we're going to come back to what we're unhappy with now. So so all of these Age of Unreason tracks.
Oh, that's right, the new record.
Yeah, so I don't know. And I don't know if it's just a different band at this point. Like, they've switched out a lot of personnel, I feel like, between the last few and this one. Or what it is. I saw Graffin play a solo gig with his, like, bluegrass band up in Toronto last year. And it was a fucking ball. Like, it was great. He was hilarious. He was having fun on stage. He was joking about stuff.
He's like that with Bad Religion too. They're not.
I'd been a long time since I had sat down and listened to any of his like this bluegrass stuff that he does on his own. And I thought that, you know, maybe that stuff isn't all that good, but I just listened to it because, like, I was a Bad Religion fan. Like, you know, like punks do that with stuff where, like, you know, we don't listen to any polka music, but if Eric Melvin went and all of a sudden made like a polka band, all these punks would listen to it and be really into it and claim it's good polka, right? So
it's not as good as Frankie Yank, my grandparents' Frankie Yankovic records back in the day, but it's pretty good.
Lawrence Welk, baby. Lawrence Welk for life.
So I was worried that it was that, but I'm like, this is good. Like, it was a good show and he was a good performer and the songs were good and the whole thing clicked and it was great. So coming out of that, I'm ready to be, you know, back in you know, Dr. Graffin's realm here. But I don't know. None of this stuff is really working for me. And maybe I'll go and I'll hear the whole record and I'll turn around on it, which I hope, because this is a band I like. But I don't know. I don't know. Go listen to it, people, and decide what you think. The song is called Do the Paranoid Style. John Gentile is dismissive. Let's talk about one more thing and do a song.
Here's something that I don't know if I want to be dismissive of it or not. The Chats. They've released a new video. The video is for their track Pub Feed, and it's off a 7-inch of the same name. The Chats previously, they're only like 18 or 19. A year and a half ago, they had a super viral track called Smoko. And I thought, have you guys heard this song, I'm on Smoko?
Nope.
Well, I don't know what that is.
It was a gigantic, I mean, it seriously had like 6 million views on YouTube, which for a punk band is insane. You know, most punk bands get about 500 views. So it had like 6 million views. And I'm on Smoko was a very late retro, you know, pulled back, simple track, but it was catchy. And Pub Feed is about the same. It's pretty funny. It's catchy. I dig it, but it's very retro. Briefly, Adam and Tom, did you guys dig this track, or was it too retro for you? Was it too silly for you? Or did you think it was cool?
I'm into this. It's cool. I'm down. It's an old throwback garage sounding, you know, tune. If you want to really criticize it, it probably smacks a little bit of that, like, early 2000s kind of like return to rock era in like the, in the post Strokes White Right Stripes universe, where a lot of bands were making records that sounded like they were from the 70s when they really clearly weren't, right? So you could maybe throw that criticism at it, but you know, it's a big dumb fun song with Australians yelling about how they like pub food. I can't shit on that.
Thomas,
I must say, much like my sixth grade daughter, I did not do my homework. I didn't finish my homework. So I actually did not check it out.
Fair. Now, here's why I really went. I dug this. So I thought it was amusing. I am going to go see them live because they're going on a really big tour real soon. Tell me if I'm paranoid or not. You know, there's been within the past 2 years a trend of seemingly DIY bands exploding out of nowhere. But not only do they explode out of nowhere, they have very expensive websites. They've got well-booked tours. They've got videos that go viral. And I wonder if there's something behind it.
Somebody's got some money.
But I'm thinking, can there possibly be any money of that? For a while, I thought maybe Emil and the Sniffers was on that trip because like no one had heard of them. Then all of a sudden, their cassettes were selling.
They're everywhere.
Their cassettes were selling for $200, like $200 for a cassette, you know? And well, maybe they only actually put out like 10 of them, and it's like an orchestration to get like this band notice, you know? But their video, here's the real kicker is, for this Chad's video, like this is a very expensive video to make. It might not look like it, but if you know, I know the littlest about shooting video, but they have moving shots. They're taking shots from vehicles. They have aerial shots. All of that is very, very expensive. If you're a DIY punk band, you are not self-funding that, right? Another band is the band The Regrets, which I think is kind of cool. No one heard of this band, then all of a sudden they've got like they're not even that popular. They're playing house shows in Philadelphia, or basically house shows, or actually not house shows. They're playing very small licensed venues at a show like I would throw at, right? But they've got a video that clearly costs $50,000 to make. They've got a website that costs at least $20,000 to make, or $10,000. I don't know how much it costs to make a website, but a website that's expensive to make. Now it could be that they've got friends that are good at doing this and do it for free. And that's why, am I being paranoid, you know, that there's The Regrets, Chai, Amo and the Sniffers, the Chads? Is it just because now technology is cheaper so you can make expensive videos and have expensive websites and book extensive tours out of the blue? Or is there someone behind it investing in this and seeing if they can take something, give something some authenticity by making it appear if it's organic when it's not? Am I paranoid is the question.
I don't know.
Medium, but why does it matter? Okay, so first of all, website hat on. The Chats website is a Squarespace website, so it can't be all that expensive.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It'll be expensive to me.
Well, I mean, like, Squarespace sites look good. This is not a promotion. But the, you know, they definitely had someone come in and, you know, help them with the layout and the fonts or something like that. But it is a Squarespace site. But, all right, the... My question is, does it matter?
Good question.
So because this is not a new phenomenon, but we haven't, it's something that that grappling with it felt easier back like during the authenticity wars. Back when
I just cracked the code, honestly. I just went to the Chats website. I mean, the Chats Wikipedia. They just signed Universal Music Publishing like 4 days ago. So I wonder, were they always signed to Universal Music Publishing, but they were trying to keep that on the down low?
Well, right.
And so, they're pumping money into them.
But the question is like, again, like does that matter much anymore? So back in the day, it mattered that these were independent bands versus these were bands on a major label, because being on a major label had, you know, it meant something. You're playing for the big leagues. They had all the money. You were indebted to them. You were, you know, sucking all the air out of the room where the smaller guy could be there. There's people that are doing, you know, more interesting stuff that you're doing, and it's not being forced down our throats, right? You had all these like reasons to not be into what was on the major label compared to what was on an indie label. And there was really like a clear demarcation between that. And whenever that line crossed, because, oh, all of a sudden, you know, this band signed to a major, or this major turned around and invested in these indies, you know, that would, we'd all bristle. I mean, we used to look at it and go, and see like, oh, the Dropkick Murphys have signed to what's their label called that they made up for themselves?
Born and Bred.
The Dropkick Murphys are on Born and Bred. Well, what's Born and Bred? And it's a label you've never heard of, so maybe it's an indie label. Well, no, it's not. It's, you know, some publishing deal that they cut with Warner Music or whatever. And instead of us just looking at it and going like, well, okay, I guess that doesn't matter because who gives a shit? It's the record's going to get into stores. We're looking at it going like, no, they're deceiving us because this is actually a major label and they didn't just like have the cajones to just like say like, no, whatever, it's we're on Warner Music, right? But then you would dig deeper and then find all this insidious shit where you would go like, oh, I liked Dropkick Murphys better when they were on Hellcat, which was an indie label. And it's like, well, yeah, I guess, but Hellcat's owned by Epitaph, and Epitaph's a huge company, and Epitaph and Hellcat's records are all being distributed by ADA, and ADA was owned by Warner Music, so it's just fucking Warner Music still putting that stuff into the stores. And then you would really start to think about, well, hold on a sec, how much Warner Music money is flowing upstream into Epitaph Hellcat? Nah, right? And you would just go mad trying to think about this. But at least we knew who the enemy was at the time.
Well, but, you know, Warner essentially is paying, you know, they don't care about Hellcat. They're buying credibility, you right? know?
But then stuff started to get sneakier, where you would have a band like, say...
I know the Bronx is the one you guys always talk about.
Yeah, well, the Bronx is an interesting case, but I wasn't even thinking of the Bronx. I was thinking of bands like, so you had bands that would show up on... So you had Fueled by Ramen, which was a... indie label, or at least we all assumed it was an indie label. It was, you know, owned and operated by one of the dudes from Less Than Jake, right? So it showed up first. Like the first thing that Fueled by Ramen ever released, I'm pretty sure, was a Less Than Jake, you know, tour only mail order only B-sides record or something like that. And they were releasing all this sort of weird ska adjacent indie rock at first by bands like the Impossibles and the Stereo and stuff like that. And there was nothing commercial about what Fueled by Ramen was doing. But then they had the first Fall Out Boy record come out on there, and they had the first like Paramore record, come out on there.
All Time Low,
Panic at the Disco, right? Like bands like that, where there were whispers, if you were, I guess, I don't know how loud these whispers were if you weren't, you know, helping run punk news at the time, but there were all these whispers at the time were about like, oh, no, that band that just signed, Fall Out Boy or whatever, they've been signed to Universal from the get-go, but it's better for marketing if they go release this record first on Fueled by Ramen and make it sound like they have some organic growth before they get signed to the big label. And
it's like a farm team in baseball.
Farm team, but like secret farm, like credibility farm team, right? And I don't know how true any of that was or if it's even true to Fall Out Boy, but that's sort of all the talk was about. But then it went further, where you had bands where all of a sudden they blew up because they seemed like they were blowing up, but there was some secret hidden thing that was behind it. And as soon as you learn that, you had to grapple with like, oh no, like is this band a fraud? So you had bands like Be Your Own Pet, where Be Your Own Pet all of a sudden blew up and they were everywhere and everyone loved this riotous, really fun sounding, loud punk band. But then all of a sudden it's like, no, the singer's father is an A&R person. It's like, oh, okay. So that they, you know, in a way they were born with the silver spoon, right? But we weren't made to know that. So they're not just some band that's getting attention because they're great. They might be great, but they're definitely getting attention because there's a secret back door that they know about that we don't. And then the Bronx and stuff is, you know, where they show up, and are they mysterious and cool, or is them being mysterious and cool part of the marketing ploy to actually, you know, get us to care about this band that is suddenly signed to Island Records? And it was all, it all went from being really clear cut where we were in a fucking war against the major labels, then there was all this subterfuge and Cold War shit that was happening, but then all the money fell out and the internet came and destroyed everything. And if you're on a major label today, I'm pretty sure you don't have any fucking money. And if you're on an indie label today, you don't have any fucking money either. So does any of it matter? I guess
here's what I'm coming around to. Does
it matter?
Here's why it may matter, and I think it still might matter to maybe a lesser degree, but it still might matter. The idea of punk rock, or one of the ideas of punk rock, is that this is our scene where, I guess, art or education or self-expression is the prime virtue. Making money is not the prime virtue, and making money can be harmful to the other things that we respect and represent. That's the underlying conceit, if you will. Is it true? Is it not true? That's a discussion for a different time. But assuming those things are true, then when we have a large corporation sending in secret agents and exploiting our virtues in the name of profit, the fear is that it can destroy the things that we've built ourselves just through outside influence and those kinds of things, you know. And it certainly, I'd argue it certainly did happen in the 90s. If you ask me, 90s punk is among the worst punk there is, you know. And so I guess the fears that could happen again.
Doing these retro weeks, I swear, since 95, it's just been downhill every year. I look at the list and I go, ugh.
That being said, do I think the chats or do I think the regrets are going to destroy punk? No. And I think this is relatively benign. But that being said, as a consumer or as a fan, I don't like being lied to or purposely being tricked. And I feel like that's what this is.
But, you know, the thing is, we do live in an era. I mean, this has always been true to a certain extent. If you're willing to put the time in, willing to put the work in, you can get ahead of next band, get noticed more than the next band. But never has that been more true than now. Before, it involved, I don't know, going to Kinko's and hanging things on poles or whatever right now. But fact of the matter is, if you sit there, if you have the time to meticulously edit, you can get cheap video editing software, you can make a good looking video for almost no money if you're willing to devote a shit ton of time to it. And the same with the website thing. If you've got nothing on your hands but time, and you can, you know, most of us don't, but if you did, you could do a lot of this stuff with very, very little money. So it's hard to tell if these people got any money behind her, if they just,
we know they do because they're signed Universal.
Well, they, in this case, but yeah, I'm saying in general, though, I'd hate to say that it's the same with all, you know what I mean? I don't know that you can lump them all into that category. Maybe.
So, I mean, Tom, in a way, you just described like what I am an optimist about when it comes to the internet is that, you know, all the tools are there. If you want to learn to use them, like you can make a go at it as a full independent, right? Like you can, yeah. Like you can go create a fucking home studio. You can record whatever you want on your own in your bedroom. You can, you know, make a decent sounding record based.
Well,
on
that's a little more complicated because microphones are still expensive, but yeah, website, no. You can do.
There's barriers to those things. But I mean, what I'm saying is that you can, as a hobbyist, go in and you can create all of the pieces of this. And, you know, if you want to put in the time to, you know, to hone your skills and to learn what you need to do, you know, you absolutely can go and become someone that is, you know, producing, that is doing video, that is putting out music, that is doing all these things, right? The opportunity is there to do them all. The weird flip side of that, though, is that you can do all of that and make no money because there is no money.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel like I'm more sympathetic to bands figuring out ways to get paid right now than I was before. So if Levi's is going to give Amel and the Sniffers $30,000 and then they have to be in some sort of Levi's video, well, okay, whatever. That band's got some money now so they can make some music. Or I wouldn't have necessarily thought that in the 90s, where I would have said, like, yeah, you know what? Go fucking tour and sell some t-shirts and sell some CDs, right? Like, you don't need to, like, you don't need to take, you know, money to get your song in this Jaguar commercial or whatever, right? But these days, it's like all my favorite bands have day jobs, right? They play, yeah, they all play if they can on weekends. If they're doing a tour,
you maybe do a week.
It's like, yeah, it's a week, and everyone in that band is on their vacation at the time. Like
pretty much, they all have to take vacation work, and not only that, but they have to save money before they go on tour so that they don't get behind.
Right? So
they make so little money.
And like every single fucking band I'm into these days, like that is the situation for them. So when I look at it from that standpoint,
and go like, all right, you know what? If you can somehow get paid and it means that like you don't have to go work in a lumber yard as much as you may have had to before that, then who am I to get on my high horse and be like, you know, I don't like the parent company of that company that you're with. Like,
I love that you picked. I love that you picked lumberyard. I believe 45% of all jobs in Canada are lumberyards, and the other 55% Tim Hortons.
I am pretty sure most punks work in lumberyards. That is where they work on. So I don't
know. That's where they get all that flannel from.
I'm worried about getting like too lectury about how bands are getting paid in this era where nobody's getting paid.
That's what you like. What was the term you used earlier? So I'm not going to be the gatekeeper on that. And I agree. I'm not going to be the gatekeeper on this other thing. Well, if I like a band, I'm going to listen to them.
It would be easier to attack the chats and especially Aim on the Sniffers if they didn't rock so hard, but Aim on the Sniffers are amazing. So like really the end result is all I really care about, to tell you the truth. I mean,
yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too. If they're good, I'll listen to them. I mean, if they play for a label that, you know, most of their profits come from clubbing baby seals or something. I mean, maybe I would consider not listening, but I probably would still listen.
I'm not a fan of companies being secretive and sneaky and I guess utilizing.
Well, then you better not spend any money, John, because all advertising is sneaky, manipulative,
Tom, you go to a very strong
psychological
point.
Warfare.
You go to a very strong point, and Boots Riley would agree with you and has some fairly radical ideas about how to correct that. That being said, Aim on the Sniffers are real cool. The chats, I like them, I dig them, I will go see them. Let's play a track. This is a track by a band called Dark Web, which is a Philadelphia band. They got kind of a Spitzy Ramones vibe going. This is a track called Alien Vacation off their only album. So here it is. And that was Dark Web off Suicide Bong Records doing Alien Vacation. Boys, we are running real long.
We're going for deluxe edition.
Only got into the first half. Do you guys want to bang through some stuff real quick, or do you guys want to slash it, or what do you guys want to do?
I don't know if we're capable.
So here we go, John. The pick one of these final stories, because these are all ones that I feel like you had something to say about. Pick one. We'll do it, and then we'll let Tom play something and get the hell out of here.
Okay, yeah. We're going to push some of these till next week, but here's the one I want to talk about. Dropkick Murphys, they played a St. Patrick Day tour, and at one of the shows, a guy was being kind of mean in the mosh pit, and he was, like, elbowing people, and Dropkick Murphys being the manly men that they are, they made a point to say, and he was elbowing women, which is lame, of course. And so anyways, Ken Casey started yelling at the guy and jumped into the audience to yell at the guy some more. And someone threw a full beer can and smacked Ken Casey in the head with a can of beer. Al Barr got up on stage and said, "We've been doing this a number of years, and having been here for those 21 of those years, I can tell you this is not new. When we invite you guys to come out to one of our shows, it's like saying, come to our house. And when someone disrespects us, you're disrespecting us in our house." So Dropkick Murphys thought it was lame. The guy was elbowing people, and they thought it was lame that Ken Casey got smacked in the head with a can of beer. Here's the question. Isn't Dropkick Murphys reaping what they sown? That is, don't Dropkick Murphys have like 40 songs about being drunk and fighting and being drunk and getting kicked out of the bar and being drunk and throwing beer on people? Isn't that like a good 74% of what Dropkick Murphys songs are about? The other 26 songs are about bagpipes and being Irish.
It's funny for a couple of reasons, because they play like these House of Blues type venues. That's where they play. When they play in Grand Rapids, they play it's not called House of Blues, but it's essentially our House of Blues here. Holds like 2,500, you know. But the thing is, I'll tell you what, to throw your beer at Ken Casey, you got to have a lot of spending money, because the beers are about $14 in that place. I'm not kidding. And you know, we were complaining, you know, I reviewed the Grand Rapids show last time, and I did get a little bit of blowback on it, but most people, I'd say the vast majority of the people were with me with what I was saying. But one of my observations was that Ken Casey doesn't play bass anymore. He just runs around with the microphone like a second singer. So like, he doesn't even have to set his bass down before he goes in the crowd to kick some ass. Maybe that's why he's not playing bass anymore. Takes him too long to jump into the crowd to kick some ass. Friggin' 48-year-old guy or whatever he is, fist fighting in the crowd. But you could bet that there's security right on his tail when he does that, right?
Yeah, but isn't this what they've encouraged for the past 25 years?
I mean, there's certainly a fair amount of hooliganism to what they do, but what they've really done is gotten too popular for their own good, where the crowd is not really a punk crowd anymore. That's their biggest issue, I think, honestly.
I just don't know if you can write songs for two decades about how great it is to get drunk at the bar and how all your friends are at the bar and how great it is to get in fistfights at the bar and then get mad when someone gets in a fistfight at the bar.
Hey, whatever, man. I think it's a credibility issue with them at this point, the fact that Ken keeps jumping into the crowd. I mean, Mike Ness is doing it at like 57. I mean, Ken Casey can do it at 48 or whatever.
That's a good point. Adam, why is this manufactured? Like, were they not really offended, but they wanted Ken Casey to start his fight and make themselves look
cooler? Is this a Jussie Smollett type situation where he's like, dude, I'll give you $200 if you let me come in the crowd and beat your ass? I don't know.
I mean, like, the Dropkick Murphys are a band in which pride is a big aspect of what they do, right? So, you know, they're proud of being, or at least of saying that they are Irish Americans, right? They're proud of the heritage that they're singing about. They're proud.
So they're proud boys. What you're saying.
I'm not trying to make this a racial thing, right? No, but they're, you know, there's this camaraderie that comes out of like the soccer hooliganism part of it, right? Where they're walking to the pub, you know, arms around each other's shoulders. They're all chanting the same drinking songs. So there's this family aspect to it that is a big part of their brand. So for them to, you know, have a moment where they see something, let's take it at face value and say that, like, let's say they genuinely did not want to see someone hurt in the crowd like that, right? It seems totally on brand for me for them to jump into the crowd and then not only do that, but to get up on your high horse and it's our house and all that stuff, right? Like that.
Especially when you're playing at a venue where you literally could see like 1/100th of the crowd. It's just posturing, dude.
It fits the thing. Now I'm not going to criticize them for trying to stop someone from getting elbowed in the face. Like, you know, stop.
Even if they did pay that person so they could beat them up.
Well, that's your theory, not mine. I get how it fits into their whole oeuvre of the Dropkick Murphys to kind of pull that move.
I just don't know if you can encourage people to get drunk at the bar and fight for 20 years and then get mad when someone gets drunk at the bar and fight.
Because there's an honor to they're samurais of getting drunk at the bar and
it's
fighting.
It's an artistic statement, John. It's not supposed to be taken literally.
It's you have to get drunk at the bar and then fight other hooligans in the ritual combat that they fight in. You don't just start fighting randos that are in the crowd.
That pretty much is exactly how it works, actually, Adam.
that is a good point. And that Dropkick, not the drugs conversation, but Dropkick Murphys really does they paint what would be considered a romantic picture of getting drunk at the bar and fighting, as Adam White quite wisely details or quite perceptively details. It's the story is two guys are drinking, they're hardworking, they just want to blow off their steam, you know, their friends are there, and they get into it, and they go outside, and, you know, they do that old Irish boxing
his
thing.
Girl one just, guy his girl just dumped him, and he's all like, yeah, like
it's romantic. It's like classically romantic. Like, it is meant to be, it is meant to kind of like tell that story and to establish that character and whatever. So, and to me, that fits with, you know, this is our house, we're protecting our own kind of thing.
But this house of blues that holds 3,000 people, yeah, is our house.
But the reality is that 90 bucks. I don't know, 90%, well, actually, I haven't ever really been in a drunk bar fist fight, but from my understanding, most
that's
drunk
why you have no credibility fights, John.
True. Most drunk is some jackass being drunk starting shit with some guy that he deems is weaker than him, and he just wants to be an asshole and hurt that person for no reason except to make himself feel better. That's what a real bar fist fight is. So I go back to my original question. We don't need to answer it. Dropkick Murphys has been painting this romantic picture when they know full well the real picture is something quite uglier, and they're encouraging a romanticism, and they know that their encouragement of this will cause an ugly reality. Are they allowed to complain about that ugly reality? Think about that, Punk News podcast listeners. You can reach that podcast at punknews.org with your own thoughts. Tom Trauma, hit us with a tune.
Getting pretty zen.
Yes. I'm getting zen in my age.
So I'm gonna totally shift gears, and I'm going to play a song by our former Punk News podcast producer and current producer of about three other podcast, and the late great Greg Simpson, who I always thought was
great.
All right, he's not late, he's not great, but he I always think of him as like an indie rock guy because he's always singing the praises of all these horrible wimpy indie rock bands. But he plays in a band called Doppelpopolis, and they're actually kind of funny because Greg has a mustache, for those of you who don't know, and the other guitar player slash drummer also has a mustache, and they switch back and forth between singing and playing guitar and playing drums, and that's where they get the doppelganger Doppelpopolis thing. But they both have pretty impressive caterpillars on their lips. But anyway, the band Doppelpopolis, they're pretty rock, and I don't think we've ever played them on the podcast. So what the hell is the name of the track? I think it's called Your Husband Is Dead or something like that. I gotta find it. But anyway, I'm not sure, but I'm going to play this Doppelpopolis song. This is former Punk News podcast producer Greg Simpson's band Doppelpopolis, and this is Johnny, the other guy, singing on this one. It's called I Think Your Husband Is Dead or something, but I can't find the email right now. But anyway, check it out. It's pretty cool. Doppelpopolis.
Let's go!
are back, and that is Doppelpopolis. Tom Trauma, any closing words, any advice to people that want to get in a drunken fist fight at a Dropkick Murphy show?
You just have to let it happen. You can't force it. You know, if you keep going, it will happen eventually. If you go enough, it'll happen. You don't go in with the attitude of looking for a fight. Then it ruins the fun. Let it be a surprise.
Adam Ward, last word to you. You've been rather cavalier about insidious corporations dipping into the DIY pool secretively. How long before it happens to you and your favorite bands?
Hung News is about to get bought out by Universal Music
Group. Oh, God, that would be such a great end to this
story.
Would. If someone would show up and be like, Adam,
if only we all owned a slight share.
Here's a burlap sack full of American $100 bills for your website, punknews.org. I would take that and then close the door and be like, I don't own punknews.org and run away.
And they would fire us all and hire us back at a reduced salary with less vacation time. And
if I could cash in on somehow always being on the hook for everyone's Punk News problems, I would do it in a fucking second.
And you can reach that podcast at punknews.org, and we will see you next week, unless we're bought out by Universal before that.